he was considered the rabbi's deputy, so he had a very high status. And nowadays, when he works in the meat factory, and he kills about 4,000 chickens per shift.
Welcome to The Deal with Animals. I'm Marika Bell, anthrozoologist, CPDT certified dog trainer, and an animal myself. This is a podcast about the connection and interaction between humans and other animals. Well, what an episode I have for you today. Now, I've made no secret of the fact that I was not raised in any particular religion, so all of the episodes in Series 7, Animals and the Divine, are eye-opening for me. But this one in particular just blew my mind. I'm talking to Dr. Annette Ben-Yonatan, a researcher at Tel Aviv University, whose work is as fascinating as it is disconcerting. But don't let that scare you away. We won't be going into any detailed descriptions of violence, but we are talking about animal slaughter for the purposes of kosher eating. However, this research is less about what transpires with the animals and more about the psychology and the place in Jewish society for slaughterers themselves. This really is an astonishing insight into the practices and place for violence within religion. So we had a few issues with the connection, which I was able to clean up pretty well, but despite that, I highly recommend listening to the entire episode because there are insights and surprises all the way through. We recorded this episode almost a year ago, well before all of the others in Series 7, and I just held on to it because I knew that this whole series was going to be exciting. So I hope you enjoy this one and join me for all of Series 7.
I love this question. What's the deal with animals?
What do I think is the deal with animals? I think the deal with animals, I think is all, they're awesome.
So what do you think is the deal with animals? Would you please introduce yourself and share your pronouns?
My name is Annette Ben-Yonatan, and I'm a research fellow at the Kollar-Mendmann Program for Animal Rights and Welfare in the Faculty of Law, Tel Aviv University. And my pronouns is she, her, hers.
Thank you very much.
Some more?
Yeah, so the series is going to be focused on religious practices and how that relates to human connection with animals. And I wanted to talk to you specifically because your dissertation and research has talked about practices of Orthodox Jewish slaughterers in Israel.
Yeah.
And it seems like a really interesting place to start because it's not something that really gets delved into in a lot of the research that goes on, I assume, because you need to have some sort of connection. So why don't you talk about why you decided to do this research?
Well, I became vegetarian at the age of 8. So it was always a mystery to me. What goes on through the minds of one who slaughters animals? How does he feel? What goes on in his heart? And it's something that I thought that I always want to answer to maybe talk to these kind of persons to discover what is going through their heads. Mm-hmm. But I never had the nerve to do that. And actually, it was very hard for me even to pronounce the word shochet. Shochet is a Jewish. So when I became a vegan later on, like at the age of 37 or 36, I was writing a thesis on gender and leadership of women. And when I finished writing, I wanted to proceed into a doctoral dissertation. And at the same time, I became vegan. So I was contemplating on research in another area that is more related to human-animal relations. And my advisor at the time told me, well, why not look into ecofeminism? So I started reading ecofeminism, and discovered the whole field of human-animal studies. And I thought about what can I write about? What can I, what is the most interesting thing to me to discover doing research? And so I started to delve into the Israeli scene of human-animal relations that was almost done. And one of the students I met was writing about vivisectors and researchers who actually conduct and experiments on animals. And I was contemplating with her, I was discussing with her on some topics that could that I could maybe choose as a research topic. And I told her a bit about myself, and she told me, and she said, you know, why don't you go and interview slaughterers? And I was terrified by the mere notion of me going to interview these people. And at first I thought I could not do that. And then I went home and I thought about it. And I come from a religious family. So my brother is a Haredi Jew, and he actually could introduce me to some of the people he know that are actually slaughterers. So I decided to try, and I went and met one of them, and like I started talking to him, I started asking him questions, and I discovered that I could actually sit and talk to these guys. So I approached her advisor, that became my advisor, and I decided to go for this challenge, which was not very easy for me, since I had also to go to slaughterhouses and observe the actual slaughter, and it was a difficult dissertation to write.
Yeah, it sounds intimidating. I would worry they would be very defensive. Did you find that?
Well, I think so. I chose the hermeneutics of trust. And so I went along with their answers, but I didn't make things very easy for them, because I had some questions that I wanted to answer, not only for the research community, but also for myself. And I didn't give up until I got the answer I was looking for. And sometimes they try to like maneuver things out of the topics, but I found myself like repeating the question in several modes. So eventually I got my answers.
So my first question is just to give people some background. How is violence in general seen in Jewish Orthodoxy?
Well, I think violence is seen as a part of life, as a necessary evil. And that is why slaughter is like something of a compromise. Instead of being violent towards fellow men, fellow human, it's a compromise. It's like some sort of sublimation of violence towards other humans. And it's a necessary evil, but if you have to do it, then you should do it towards animals and not towards humans. And maybe if you like satisfy this urge for violence in this way, it is more legitimate than satisfying this urge towards another human.
So are you saying that some of these slaughterers would have been violent towards humans if they didn't have a job that was slaughtering animals? Like they just were more violent personalities?
Well, not many admit it, but one, I remember one saying that if it wasn't expressed towards chickens, he would express it towards humans. And that's what the Gemara says. The Gemara is the book of and the way of conduct of the Jewish tradition. And the Gemara says that anyone who is born with an inclination to shed blood could become a circumciser, he could become a doctor, a surgeon that operates on, and he could become a murderer. And another way he could express this tendency is through slaughter of animals. So the shochet is always a suspect of violence, even though he's considered as one who is actually doing sacred duty.
So it gives them a purpose, a sacred purpose.
Yeah, I think this is the kind of things that makes them go on with their profession, with their choosing of going and performing slaughter as a profession, because a Jewish slaughter has to kill the animal, has to slaughter the animal in his own bare hands. He cannot do this using machines. He could not stun the animals. It is forbidden in the Jewish tradition to stun animals. He has to have a very robust cultural background to back him up in doing this. And it's not very easy for them nowadays. It was more easy, I think, in the days of the diaspora, where the animals were slaughtered in lesser numbers. Very few animals were slaughtered every week. Mm. So he could engage in other tasks. He could learn the scriptures. He was actually, in the past, he was the rabbi's deputy. He was considered the rabbi's deputy, so he had a very high status. And nowadays, when he works in some sort of a capitalistic factory, the meat factory, and he kills about 4,000 chickens per shift.
Wow.
Yeah. And he does that by hand.
And that must take a psychological toll on anyone doing that.
Yeah, you would think that. But what I found out is that the psychological toll is actually very rare.
Is it, you believe, because their background is seated in this sacred work, in the scriptures, that it's very easy to justify that killing?
Yeah, of course. But, you know, there's the level of what you declare, the declarative level, and there is the actual level, the level of in reality, and you actually do the things you do. You go to work every day. So sometimes they have a sort of incidents with animals that are not expected. For example, when the first time they slaughter, they actually very, very excited or feared. They attest for themselves that the first time of the slaughter is something you have to go through in order to become a slaughterer, because the first time is the most significant time, where it's the first time you kill someone. And then when you get used to it, it becomes some sort of habit. And it's not exciting, or it's not so frightening anymore. It becomes like, you know, some sort of an act that you don't even think about it. And of course, there is the five rules of halacha, that is a technical rule that they have to keep. And if they concentrate on that, they can forget about what they actually do, that they actually kill the animal. And I think the halakha, the Jewish halakha, it gives them enough things to occupy themselves with, that the animal or the individual animal can be set aside and not thought of.
Is killing animals in other contexts seen differently then? Say it wouldn't be a part of the tradition to kill animals outside of this particular method, but would that also be considered immoral to kill an animal that way? Or is it simply the act of killing that becomes moral when it's done in this way?
Well, I can say that in general, slaughter is still the world through hierarchical cosmology headed by humans. And that is why they argue it is allowed to use animals for what they consider as justified reasons. Mm-hmm. For example, experiments, clothing, and for any other material need. They can definitely object to hunting or using animals for purposes of pleasure, like circuses or bullfights, etc. And some of them even raise animals at home as a way of teaching their children compassion. So they can have birds or hamsters or rabbits in their households. And when they do, they make sure to supply them with the needed needs, like water, food, and clean shelter, as well as respect and compassion. And you can say that even through this perspective, we're still talking about using animals to teach compassion rather than taking care of animals for the animal's own benefit. But in the case of compassion, the slaughterers will treat them rather kindly in case of companion animals that they host in their homes.
Did you find that when they were performing slaughter, that they would see these particular animals, were they being respectful? Is that part of it? Is they see themselves as respecting that animal and almost the way hunters sometimes describe it as thanking the animal, understanding the animal's sacrifice, even though it's obviously not up to the animal. But a lot of people see it that way as a way of sort of justifying that killing for the need of others.
Yeah, so actually animals that are labeled as being kosher, as well as animals from which humans benefit materially, like those I just mentioned, are destined to be slaughtered or exploited in some other way. But actually, the slaughterers do not want these animals to suffer. And they believe these animals don't suffer in the process of kosher slaughter. This is something the slaughterers are quite confident about. So they don't think slaughter is the opposite of mercy. However, I can say that during my research, it was possible to identify cracks in this position. For example, one slaughterer I interviewed claimed that he was an animal lover. By the way, many of them describe themselves as animal lovers. And he told me that one time prior to a slaughter, he used to pet. Generally, he would go out and pet the cows and take their pictures. And one day he had a special encounter with one particular calf. And sadly, he had to slaughter him. He had to slaughter this calf the very next day. And I could feel his pain while he was telling me this story. But nevertheless, he didn't give up on the slaughter. He didn't go away. He encountered the slaughter and he actually performed the act finally. So we can talk about the declarative level that permits the use of animal, while in reality, other things happen, often unexpectedly, like such as this encounter with the calf.
Can you tell us about the encounter? What happened?
Well, Jewish slaughterers go abroad to slaughter. You know, Israel is a very small country, and it doesn't have much land to graze animals, or to raise animals outside. Where, of course, we're talking about cows, like livestock, cows and sheep. Mostly. And so they have to go abroad to countries that have this kind of lands that do grow animals, like Brazil, Argentina. And in these countries, they have big factory farms, and they grow the animals just outside the premises of these plants. And so the slaughterers are not working in Shabbat, in Saturday, And the other workers will not work on Sundays because they're Christians. So on Sundays, they sometimes go and visit those animals. And this particular shochet told me about his travels in the cowshed of Brazil on Sunday, actually. So he would go and pet those cows, and he met this brown calf, which he called Bambi. So that was the name he gave him. And he took pictures of him and stroking him. And the next day, he came under his knife, as we say. And he recognized that calf. And he was feeling... He had no words to describe the way he felt, but I could see that he was in pain. And actually, you know, Sutter is ultra-Orthodox man. And often when I went to interview them, I had to go to their homes and sit around with them. And because I was a woman, I had to sit around with their wives, so that we will not be in the same room without, you know, it is forbidden in the Jewish tradition that a married woman would sit around with a married man, that is not married will sit together. So she sat with him, and when she saw he was startling, she started to laugh in order to, you know, to ease the atmosphere. So it was kind of awkward, but this was his story, and I could feel his pain while telling this story.
Slaughtering seems like it would be very dehumanizing work. It would make you feel separate from other people who didn't experience that experience. Because there's a certain type of emotion, as he obviously experienced killing someone he actually knew. That other people are just never going to have, hopefully. So how did he cope with that emotional baggage? Was he just compartmentalizing it and just trying not to think about it until you asked him?
Yeah, I guess so, because I asked him, what did he take forward from that experience? And he told me, well, I instantly remembered that the purpose of my action is to serve God, and I'm not more merciful than God. And this is one of the most common justifications for slaughterers. They can be more merciful than God. And if God permitted the act of slaughter of animals and eating their flesh, the mere statement of the animal, like if you fulfill compassion towards animal and you decide not to eat them, it's a heresy, actually.
During this quick break, I want to tell you about last week when I attended the Humane Society of the United States Animal Care Expo in New Orleans, Louisiana. I was invited to speak about podcasting with a purpose, how to share your message using a podcast. It was a presentation about the importance of hearing the voices of those in the animal welfare and advocacy movement using the accessible medium of podcasting, and about my goal for the next year of starting a podcasting network for beginner podcasters in these organizations. As part of my talk, I promised a few shout-outs, so here are two of them now. The first is Cameron Bonito from Underdog Animal Rescue and Rehab. Their mission is to rescue and rehabilitate companion animals from the Four Corners reservations of the American Southwest through vet care, spay, neuter, and adoption services while supporting Native Americans in their care of their animals. How awesome is that? I bet Cameron has some fantastic stories. The next shout out is to Katrina Johnson at the Humane Society of Truckee, Tahoe, whose mission is dedicated to saving and improving the lives of pets through adoption, community spay-neuter, and humane education programs. Thank you so much, Katrina, for being an enthusiastic listener. See what I did there? Sorry, a little in-joke. And for your work with the pets and communities of Truckee. If you would like more information about the new podcast network project, go to thedealwithanimals.com scroll to the bottom of the page and sign up for the newsletter to keep updated. I'll be giving more shout-outs from the conference in the next few episodes. So, okay, now back to this episode.
So a vegetarian or a vegan would be committing heresy by just choosing not to eat meat?
If the reason for vegetarianism or veganism is compassion towards other animals, then yes. Wow. They actually see that as a heresy. But if vegetarianism or veganism is induced by health reasons or environmental reasons, then, or even making you more cruel or more violent, then it is justifiable to stop eating meat or even stop slaughtering. There was one slaughterer who told me that once he felt he was influenced by the violence he commits towards the animals, he stopped, not only stopped slaughtering them, but also stopped eating them. Because he said that the slaughter industry is a violent industry. And if you let it influence you as a human being, then you shouldn't participate in it.
Which goes almost opposite to what you were saying at the very beginning, which was that the slaughtering of animals could help, or they saw it as almost helping them stop other violent tendencies. But you're saying for him, it actually increased his violence.
Well, actually, the slaughterer, as I said, is actually perceived as someone who is always suspected of being prone to violence. But violence, I think, as an entity, is something that is recognized as fluid and something that needs to be holded inside, you know, handled some way. So it doesn't stop there. It doesn't stop where you can express your tendencies through some legitimate form of violence. But you constantly have to work and actively have to work, psychological work, in order to prevent its influences to become evident in your everyday life. You have to study the Torah and you have to engage in some sort of measurement, your qualities as human being, your values maybe. And you have to constantly work on that. You have to be engaged in philanthropy towards other humans in order to curb this violent acts that the slaughterer is always engaged in. The Gemara says that anyone born under the sign of Mars will have tendency to shed blood, whether it's Ohel, who performs ritual circumcisions, doctor, murderer, or slaughterer. And so the slaughterer is actually perceived as someone who is always suspected of being prone to violence, but not only the slaughterer, but all the others that I mentioned right now. The culture directs you in a way that you can express this violence in a legitimate way, but it's a constant work that you have to do. It's not just go and slaughter and this will be the end of it, because violence is a two-ended sword. Like on the one hand, it ventilates violence if you slaughter animals, but on the other hand, it can make you like more enthusiastically engage in violence or in more violence. So the first step is actually to engage in some way that ventilates the violence. But the second step is to engage in acts that are opposite to violence towards humans. On one hand, ventilate the violence using animals. And the second step is to actively engage in acts of generosity and philanthropy towards human beings, towards other human beings.
I find it really interesting too that doctors are put under that same umbrella, because often doctors are seen really as almost the opposite of violence. Even though they perform cutting and they perform surgeries that hurts while it heals, it's still seen as a compassionate act. You know, it's not seen as a violent act. You seem to be, or the Orthodoxy culture seems to be looking at it as the actual just physical act, whatever that physical act is. It doesn't matter the reasoning behind it. If the physical act is violence, then it is a violent profession.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's the same for researchers who engage in medical experiments on animals. They enjoy the aura of progress and the aura of compassion towards other humans. I think it's just a spirit of time. Like, I think in the time of the Gemara was written, they were seen otherwise. They were seen as shedding blood. And actually, the medicine back then, it was like 2,000 years ago, leaned upon shedding blood as a medicine, even through leeches. They used to think that shedding blood itself contributed to the health of the individual. They didn't have like a very elaborated or sophisticated medicine. So we have to remember that this Gemara was written back then, like 2,000 years ago, not nowadays. But actually, when I shared the tractate with some physicians of mine or that I know, some of them were offended. And some of them told me, well, there is something about it, because a surgeon is a person who likes to cut through the body, and he enjoys that. And some of them even admitted that they have to cut someone. They have to cut someone in order to feel like to release some urge inside of them. I don't know if they really examine this tendency of theirs psychologically, or I don't even know if there are some studies written on that issue. But several of them really admitted that they have this tendency to cut through the body.
It's a sense of satisfaction for them. And
like that.
Not necessarily the fact that they're healing somebody by doing that, but just the actual sensation of being able to cut through a body is actually very satisfying. And I imagine that, put in like separate rooms, a murderer, a physician, a slaughterer, who all enjoy their work and feel like they're doing something that they want to be doing. So if you didn't know which was which, and they were just talking about what they were doing, it would be really interesting to hear how similar they described their work.
And the slaughterers often compare themselves to surgeons.
Yeah.
But I think they want to compare themselves, you know, they want to highly evaluate their profession. So they find a similarity between being a slaughterer and being a surgeon.
You were saying that they're suspected of having a tendency to violence if they are a slaughterer or a physician, or I can't remember what you said before.
Circumcisors.
Oh, yeah. They have this tendency. Does that mean that people don't want to associate with them as much because of this concern that they might be a violent person in general?
Well, the thing that is important to mention is that in Jewish communities during the diaspora, the slaughterer was the rabbi's deputy. And so many people wanted to be close to him. His status was very high. It is significant that at that time, slaughter was not carried out on a daily basis, but only once or twice a week. And in fact, the slaughterer in that era served in additional roles, and he was also a devoted scholar of the scriptures. And that was the main reason for his high status. From the perspective of the time that has passed since, nowadays, slaughterers work in a capitalist meat factory, just like in typical Western countries. The slaughterer must also be very skilled in his work so that he can fulfill the five laws of slaughter. And he must be able to sharpen the knife so that it is as sharp and smooth as required. And of course, he needs to be a very religious person. But despite all this, he still works in a capitalist factory and is required to slaughter by hand no less than 12 chickens per minute, for example. So after such a long and exhausting shift, he no longer has the same ability to engage in other things, like studying the scriptures. So it becomes a job like every other job. And on top of that, meat is not such a valuable product as it was in the past. So his status has declined accordingly. Now, another thing is worth saying in this context is that there has been a cultural shift in Israel towards veganism in the last decade. The vegan movement in Israel has gained strength and resonance. And accordingly, the slaughterer's profession, which was mostly tainted in the physical sense, is also becoming morally blemished as well in terms of dirty work theory. Mm. Now, Israel is a state that hosts many subcultures and rifts, one of which is the religious secular divide. So this idea of moral taint is considered more secular, while in ultra-Orthodox society, the slaughterer is still considered as one who performs sacred work.
Mm.
But still, albeit on a small scale, slaughterers are dealing with stigma they experience on the part of their own communities. For example, one of the slaughterers told me that an acquaintance of his asked him how many cows the kashrut staff slaughtered every day. And when he told him the number seemed to be very high. So he told him that it reminded him of ISIS or the Holocaust. So by and large, we would say that there has been a steady erosion in the status of Jewish slaughterer. And the stigma they feel and they receive is both from the secular population in Israel, but we can surely say that even in religious populations are becoming more stigmatic towards the slaughterers.
Was there anything else you would want to say about this? Anything to kind of wrap up or takeaways that you would want people to think about?
There is something that I was asked in one of my talks, and I know something very important to note about the distinction between Jewish slaughter, kosher slaughter, and other forms of slaughter. So one time at a lecture I gave at Oxford, a person from the audience asked me, if you were an animal, how would you prefer to be slaughtered? And I replied that I would have preferred to continue living, and that it was difficult for me to think of a better way to die, whether by kosher slaughter or by stunning. And I think this question of what is a better death for the animal is not really a fair question, because I think it forces us to do two things. One is to be immersed in a culture of violence where all choices are bad, and we tell ourselves that one way is worse than the other, and then somehow come to terms with the lesser of the two evils, or what we think is the lesser of two evils. But actually, in answering such a question, we give our implied consent to violence. The second thing it forces us to do is get into the animal's mind. And that's something I do not have the tools or the desire to do. It supposedly gives us the right to think for someone else what is good for him. And in my opinion, we cannot do that in any situation for the other, certainly not for animals whose otherness is absolute, relative to human beings who can actually speak and express their thoughts.
So let me ask you the questions that I ask all of my guests, which the first is, if there was a book that you could share with all of the listeners, what would that be?
Well, a book that I recommend is Matthew Scully's Dominion.
Mm-hmm.
This book promotes responsibility of humans towards other animals, and I support its rationale and its main argument. and so-called chosen humans, the ones who possess power over the earth, especially in the Anthropocene, should also bear responsibility for weaker subjects who don't possess such access to power. And for me, this argument holds not only for animals, but for oppressed and poor populations of humans as well.
And is there a formative memory that you would share with us, a childhood memory of your connection with animals?
Well, I can tell a story about the case after which I became a vegetarian. When I was about 7.5 years old, my grandfather brought home a crate with the chicks. My grandparents lived in the village and I spent a lot of time with them as a child. Unfortunately, the chicks died one after the other and only one chick remained alive. And that chick grew up. And one day my grandfather said that we should move him to the neighbor's yard so that he could have friends to play with. And of course, I agreed. And occasionally I would go to visit him. But the visits finished over time. And one day we sat down to Shabbat dinner with the whole extended family, my uncles and aunts and the children and my parents and brother and of course my grandparents. And I remember exactly where I sat. I really liked to eat meat. And of course at this meal, I also took a piece of chicken. And while I was eating this chicken, my grandmother leaned towards me and said, "Do you know what you're eating?" And so I found out that I was eating that person whom I had known since he was a chick. This was the point where I realized I was eating someone and not something. Of course, I got up from the table and went to cry in the room, and I no longer touched meat.
It's interesting how often I hear a similar story from people who have become vegetarian and vegan around a family dinner table when they first learned, and actually eating an animal that they knew well is such a emotional shock to children and something they have not come to terms with the way an adolescent or an adult has for people who have eaten meat their whole life. And I wonder if that, I don't know, I wonder when that happens to someone, if that is like a critical learning period for people within a certain age range that happens. And if that is the time that they are exposed to this idea, then they almost always become vegetarian or vegan versus, I just wonder how many children this sort of thing has happened to and they don't decide to become vegetarian or vegan.
I think it has a lot to do with how their parents react.
Mm.
Because if their parents allow them to pursue vegetarianism or veganism, and they actually support them in their way, they would still stay vegetarians or vegans, and they would actually listen to their hearts. But if they don't get the support, and even the opposite, It wouldn't work. It wouldn't last. I have known many persons who, as children, had the same event happening to them, and they didn't become vegan or vegetarian. I was very tenacious, and also my parents couldn't resist me. So it was soon enough that I got my own plates and forks and knives and even pots, and I would not agree that anything who touches meat was served to me. And they just went along with me and they didn't resist me. So I think they deserve a big thank you for that. And also my grandmother, you know, many people say, wow, that's a horrible thing to say to a child, but I thank her. I really thank her for opening my eyes.
She was trying to be funny. She was trying to be cruel. She was trying to just let you know what was going on.
I don't really know what was she trying to do. I do think that it's hard for me to speculate on that because she's very dear to me. She's 91 now. and I visit her every Saturday, and I love her very much. And she's a very affectionate person, but in that same event, I don't really know why. I'd like to think that this was meant to be, and I was meant to be vegetarian and then vegan and then to engage in human-animal relations scholarship and research. And that's what led her to do that. She was a messenger of God or whatever.
So it really doesn't matter what her intention was at the time.
Yeah. What's important is that I became a vegan vegetarian. Yeah.
So what do you think is the deal with animals?
Well, regarding this question, I'm not one of those people who would give a post-humanist statement about humans as equals to animals or tell you we're all actually animals. I think humans have changed nature so much to such an extreme degree that we can no longer really talk about natural life. I think humans have made very big leaps, for example, in overcoming diseases or dangers related to nature. And in this process, we have moved very far away from nature. I do not oppose the notion that humans are significantly different from animals and that there are boundaries between us that we may never cross. These processes have made us so strong that we actually rule the world. But here the question of the responsibility of the strong towards the weak arises. And just as parents are responsible for the well-being of their children, yeah, they're so precious children. And we know that we should take care of them and not the other way around, and that we are strong and therefore need to help them grow. So when I think about human relations with animals, this is my ideal. It includes benevolent responsibility and care for the fate of animals, which we seem to have left behind in our search for more comfortable ways for us to live in the world. When I read the biblical story of creation of the world, I think of animals as our siblings. After all, they too were created by the same God who created us. And if they are our siblings, that means we need to take care of them too. And unfortunately, most people do the exact opposite.
Thank you. And thank you so much for being a guest today. Really fascinating topic and conversation.
Thank you. Thank you, Marika, for inviting me. And I really enjoyed talking to you about this.
That was Dr. Annette Ben-Yonatan, research fellow at Kohler Memnon Program for Animal Rights and Welfare and the Faculty of Law, Tel Aviv University. You can find her articles surrounding this work at researchgate.net, and I've linked them in the show notes as well.
If you enjoyed this show and have any questions or comments about this episode or about the podcast in general, go to thedealwithanimals.com and leave me a message. This is also a great place to go if you're interested in being a guest or have an idea for a series or episode. And don't forget to follow and review wherever you listen to your podcast, as it helps us become more visible to other listeners. I'm your host, Marika Bell. I'd like to thank Kai Stranskoff for the theme music and Natasha Matsark for help with editing. You can see links to guest book recommendations, as well as their websites and affiliated organizations, in the show notes and at thedealwithanimals.com. Thank you for joining me as we try to answer the question, what's the deal with animals? What do you think is the deal with animals?
The Deal with Animals is part of the iROAR Animal Podcast Network.